I don't know which is harder, following Roy Blunt Jr. or following lunch. But I think I've got my answer now. Lunch is definitely harder. After last year's conference, someone asked me what the theme of this year's conference should be. What's next? I told him. We've been in the South, we've been living in the past for so long. Maybe it's time we thought about taking Southern food into the future. So when I heard that this year's topic was moving on, I was ready. I'm the food editor of what could be called the quintessential New South city. Charlotte has a gleaming skyline, a robust economy, and a population that is a small number of natives and an overwhelming number of newcomers. People who don't understand our traditions, much less why we insist on clinging to them. They don't want biscuits. They want New York rye. They hate our grits. And they feel alienated by our accents and our love of our own history.
Okay.
If Walt Kelly, the cartoonist, were living in Charlotte today, his pogo would say, "We has met the enemy, and they is living with us." But too often, we've sold the world a version of the South that is cornpone and mushmouth. We present ourselves as hicks and then wonder why the world treats us like ones. Perhaps we're getting the last laugh. In January, a friend of mine called me very excited because he had seen something on eBay, a can of Andy Griffith Navy beans. Did you guys see this? They sold for $305. Seriously. I don't make things up. I'm a journalist. Come on. 3 weeks ago at Balducci's, the gourmet food store that's just a few blocks from James Beard's house in New York, I saw a bag of white lily flour, 2-pound bag, $2.50. The same bag of flour sells in my food line for $1.09. Maybe we should change Pogo's saying, "We has met the enemy, and he'll pay a lot to be one of us." I'd like to introduce our panel, who know, they all know something about selling the South. Natalie Dupree is a cookbook author, cooking teacher, and TV personality. She was one of the first to bring Southern cooking to a wider audience. Linda Carman is former director of consumer affairs in the test kitchen for Martha White Foods, and she's currently the Martha White spokesperson and Southern baking consultant. Goodness gracious, she's pea-picking wise. John Floyd is editor of Southern Living, the guidebook to the Southern lifestyle. And Bill Williams is president and founder of Glory Foods, a line of Southern-style canned vegetables, frozen entrees, and Mound Bayou sweet potatoes. A graduate of the Culinary Institute of America, he's received numerous awards, including the Ron Brown Award for Corporate Leadership presented by President Clinton. And I'd like to open by asking each panelist to tell us briefly a little bit about their company and their work with taking the South outside the South.
Shall I start?
You may start.
Well, I think it's been an interesting history for Martha White Foods. It started 101 years ago on the banks of the Cumberland River in Nashville, Tennessee, when Richard Lindsay named his best-selling family flour for his little baby daughter, Martha White. And about 40 years later, Cohen Williams took that same company and decided that he needed to do something to compete with the Pillsbury's and the General Mills's of the world, because there he was in Nashville, and what was he going to do but sell self-rising flour and self-rising cornmeal, because the consumers were making biscuits and cornbread. So it made a lot of sense. And Cohen was a wise man. He decided what his approach was going to be, and he stuck with it for years. He decided to advertise Martha White on WSM radio. He went up to East Tennessee and hired Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs to come to Nashville and sing on the Grand Ole Opry. And so as a result, his products were known all over. Mindy and Merrill and I were just at the Grand Ole Opry last Saturday night, and they were saying that the WSM Clear station reaches into 38 states. So it got the message across early on. So Cohen advertised on WSM. He had Lester and Earl to sing the praises of Martha White, and he started the test kitchen. So he had this kind of built-in idea about embracing the southernness of the food. But when I went to Martha White 25 years ago, he was still coming in every day. We perked coffee for him in the Martha White test kitchen. He'd come back there to get him a cup. And he always wanted to know what you were doing, He wanted to know if it was easy to make. Could you put it in a pouch? He loved those little pouch mixes because he thought that everybody wanted something that was easier. And Cohen was not really interested, to tell you the truth, about whether it was Southern or not. He knew who his consumer was. They were Southern. And if it made it easier, he was all for it. And that was the thing that really took Martha White outside the Deep South, were those little pouch mixes, First Biscuit Mix, Cornbread Mix, Cotton Pickin' Cornbread Mix, which was one of the first Southern-style cornbread mixes made out of white cornmeal. But Cohen Williams was not above Yankee cornbread. He also did corn muffin mix in a pouch. Didn't matter to him what kind of cornbread people ate, as long as they were eating Martha White. So that with that kind of approach, too, he was a lot more interested in the consumer and what they needed than in. So we really focused on him, and it really didn't matter to him, to tell you the truth, whether it was Southern or not. It just happened to be that he was located in Nashville, Tennessee.
Well, you know, it's trying to get it all into 3 minutes. And by the way, there is a fee if anyone falls asleep that, you know, you have to talk the next. I'm really a cooking teacher. I love teaching cooking. That's what I do, I think, the best and that I love the most. And when it came time after 10 years of teaching at Rich's Cooking School, I had been writing for a small Georgia publication called Brown's Guide to Georgia. And in that, I had started codifying the techniques of Southern cooking, how to make a biscuit, how to make cornbread, how to fry chicken. And it sounds so self-evident now, but you know what? I found out that nobody makes it all the same way, that this person makes it that way and this person makes it that way, and that no two people agree. We've been having a fight all day. Well, really, since the food section of the Journal of the Constitution came out on Thursday about whether or not to put salt in your black-eyed peas when you cook them. So, you know, you begin to learn that the South is not just one place, but the South is this broad place of a lot of people who cook a lot of different ways. And so at that point, White Lily Flour had come to me because I was the first person, they said, that put in print what they felt was true, which was that Southern flours, soft wheat flours, were different than non-soft wheat, than northern flours, we call them. And so they asked me to have a public television, to do a public television show. Now, meanwhile, Bill Rice had told me that I should write a Southern settlement cookbook. And I tried to sell that, but nobody wanted to buy it. So I did find someone who would take the new Southern part of it. And so I was writing and did New Southern Cooking, and that fit right in with what White Lily wanted. It took me a while because I did not think of myself as a television person. I thought of myself as a teacher. So it took me a while to agree to it, but we did do that television show called New Southern Cooking, and then I wrote the book, New Southern Cooking, which has just gone out of print 15 years and 14 editions later. As one of the really best-selling cookbooks outside of Southern Living, which we don't really think counts because they have all that money and all those people that buy them. I don't want to know how many cookbooks Southern Living sells. You know, I just want to know, you know. But for non-Southern Living cookbooks, this is a good-selling cookbook. So what I had to do was to try to maintain as much integrity as possible in representing what was going on in the South without limiting the South to the external perceptions of the South. And it was, I did not realize that I was creating a firestorm in getting half of the world's backs up because I was saying you don't always have to use fat back, and have the food police mad at me because I said, there are times when you want to use fat back. And lard has been a subject of discussion today, but I was forced by my editor, Judith Jones, to take out all references to lard. And we did get to a set down about that. The previous editor and I had a fight about a lot more, so she didn't publish the book, and then Judith took it over. But it was very hard to maintain that fine line of integrity. And what I have tried to do all the way through with Southern cooking is to maintain the integrity of what I know of as the South, and not be swept into restaurant cooking or embroidering on food, which is a part of restaurant presentation, but to be true to what I felt was going on within Southern homes. That's the only way that I know to publicize the South. I think that at the point that we begin to compromise what we know, at the point that we say, that the point that we deny that the Southern woman that works for me, that's Kate's 76 or 78 now, that the point that we deny that she's cooking something that's very nouvelle from New York, we're foolish. Of course those things mix into our cuisine. But at the same time, we cook traditional things. So that, I think, is the only thing I can say about promoting the South, is that I promoted it from a position of I wasn't going to tell a lie. I was going to try to tell it like it is, like I knew it, not like someone else's perception of it. And it worked for me. I also made a point of going to all, we did 52 location segments all over the South, just seeing how Southern ingredients were picked and grown and planted. We did turnip greens and peaches and peas and peanut butter. But we looked at them all, as many of them as we could, cantaloupe, melons, and all of that, because that presented it to the South. And people still talk to me now about those early shows and how they learned where things came from. You know, that peas come out of beans, that kind of thing.
I'm Bill Williams from Columbus, Ohio. Started a company 10 years ago called Glory Foods. My home, we moved to Columbus, Ohio at a very early age, and my family, we prepared grains, neck bones, all of the traditional Southern food items. I then went to the Culinary Institute, started at a very early age, apprenticing and learning the culinary cooking. Started a restaurant there in Columbus, Ohio, marketing to middle-income African-Americans. Pretty much still not doing Southern foods, though. Tried to start a business marketing foods to the grocery industry, and I wasn't very successful at it. I then tried to determine what was missing in the grocery stores, and what was not being done was foods marketing to African Americans. And so I came up with the idea then of Glory Foods, came up with initially 17 items that would be a convenient item marketed to the new modern African-American woman who did not have time to prepare a traditional Southern meal. And I could prepare all of the side dishes that would be easy for the modern African-American woman. And then she could take a pork chop, fry it quickly, have my greens, my black-eyed peas, cornbread, and have a simple, convenient meal. We started there in Columbus, Ohio. It went extremely well, much better than the grocers expected. We then thought we would test market it then in Atlanta. We knew that if it worked in Atlanta, it would work throughout the country. And at the time, I was only looking at the 20 largest cities with African Americans in it. And truly, I had no experience at that time with Southern whites eating the types of foods that I grew up with. But then our sales were growing so large and so fast, I realized something was going on that I didn't understand. And we then got very busy at really learning myself, who had had the culinary background. Those of you here know that Culinary Institute 30 years ago certainly didn't teach anything about Southern cooking. So I've been very busy in the last 10 years, really visiting all of the restaurants that are represented here, reading all of the cookbooks and magazines, and trying to educate myself on what is really going on with Southern foods. And I have become really an expert in the last 10 years at knowing Southern foods. And I think that I have found something that most manufacturers still do not know. And I'm going to really spend the rest of my life concentrating on Southern cooking. And I make no apologies for Southern foods. I enjoy it. I think my customers enjoy it, and it's been very good for me.
Well, I won't tell you about myself because that's not very interesting, but the magazine is right interesting, and I won't tell you how many cookbooks we sold this year either. But I will say this, that we have about 2.5 million subscribers and between 13 and 14 million readers every month, which approximately 10% of those outside the South. I'll say it's a little different than a lot of people south. A gentleman sitting next to me at lunch was amazed that our largest state of circulation is Texas. It's always been Texas. Our South goes from Texas to Missouri, across to Delaware, and down to Florida. So we represent a large portion. I think the unique thing about Southern Living is that it's a magazine for middle-class Southerners who enjoy living in the South, and that it's totally reader-based. It's probably one of the most reader-based magazines in American publishing today. And we've tried to maintain that in our entire 30-plus years of existence. I think the other thing that's maybe that makes us really unique is that we started a concept in food a number of years ago of reader-based recipes, and we have a rather large test kitchen staff in every recipe that we produce, and we produce over 800 recipes in our magazines annually, are kitchen-tested and rated, and every product that we purchase is purchased out of a grocery or a food market versus being a wholesale-based thing. So we know what every recipe, we have a rating on every recipe, we know what every recipe costs. And I have an old saying, if you can't buy it in Op, Alabama, you better tell them where they can get it if they have to call and mail order it. So we're very, very based on the South, and that's our hallmark.
Thank you. We thought what we would do is I've got some questions for each of them, and we were going to go through those briefly, and then we were going to throw it open to questions from everyone. And we are trying to move things along because I know we're off on time. I thought I'd start with Natalie. What was the hardest concept for producers and publishers to understand when you approach them about Southern cooking?
Well, I think the hardest concept still is that different things are available in our grocery stores, that we do shop differently, we do live differently, we do cook differently. Someone recently told me that they thought I was the only woman that still cooked. And this was a New Yorker. And I said, no, I don't think so. It's just that you live up here. But if you live in Social Circle, Georgia, or even Oxford, Mississippi, where I lived, you know, you have to cook. You can't go out to eat every night. This is not New York City. And really feel satisfied with your food. So I think addressing myself to the home cook, doing what you do, buying everything that I use in a local grocery store, the only thing that I make an exception for is Parmigiano Reggiano. But I justify that because it's in, you know, all these old cookbooks like Martha Washington's and stuff. But having people understand that home cooking is still sought after and a viable way of life in the South and necessary in the South, I think is the hardest thing to communicate, certainly to the publishers. I was really amazed when New Southern Cooking went national. We had really planned to market it just to the seven-state area that, I think it's seven states, that the company sold to, the sponsor sold to, but it got picked up in Seattle, Washington, and Oregon. I mean, I can't walk down the street without in Seattle or San Francisco without somebody stopping me that knows the show from all the way back from New Southern Cooking, because people still want to learn how to feed themselves. And that's the hardest thing now, right now, because the big push is to look at restaurant chefs and restaurant cooking. And as wonderful as our meal was today, Southern cooking is still a home-based cuisine to me, and always will be. Chefs always, they just have more resources than the home cook does. You're just not going to put that last thing on there if you're the home cook, because you have to get it on the table. You know, you have to feed your family. And I always say that food is a control issue. I learned it by living in the South. You know, whoever controls the food controls the household. And in the South, it was women and blacks. And we are not going to give that up easily. Are we? No, right. So for that reason, it's hard to explain that to non-Southerners.
Bill, one thing you had mentioned about your product that I wanted to ask about, we didn't talk about this earlier, new question. You were talking about the fact that your product was something you were looking at for convenience and to make it easier for people. Isn't your product also a healthier version of some of these traditional African American foods?
Yes.
Is that a consideration for you?
Yes. We try to accomplish all things. our motto on our can says, Glory Food, just about the best. We recognize that we cannot produce a green that matches your greens that you prepare on Sunday. But on Tuesday...
He's right.
Thank you. On Tuesday, I'm the champ. Because you've been working. If you want to provide a green for your family, I have just about the best. I haven't put as much salt, sodium in the can as you can put in the can. I haven't put as much fat in the can that you can put on Sunday. But we have a very flavorful product. There's some other things that I can't do that you can do to make it absolutely perfect. And if I could do your greens in a can, I would, because that's the product that everyone wants. And it's the best product, actually. I love going out to restaurants and having some greens that are perfectly seasoned and perfectly cooked. But I'm trying to be just about the best.
Okay. Mr. Floyd, can you talk a little bit about how a magazine with such a Southern identity competes in a national market? And I think we were talking earlier, too, about how you've changed to draw in a younger audience.
Well, certainly we are a regional magazine with a national base in terms of advertising. And really, our circulation, we actually sort of hold our circulation down outside the South. We could easily increase our circulation dimensionally outside the South if we wanted to. But basically, our marketing position is for Southerners, and something that we were talking about at lunch. It's hard to realize that half of our readership now are not Southern born. There's Southerners who live in, people who've moved to the South that want to enjoy the Southern way of life. Everybody thinks, oh, wow, that's pretty amazing. But it's truly, if you look at the South, it's not, it's the lifestyle that's the real thing that people are enamored about. Our average age of our readers is 48, with the highest renewal rate of one of the highest renewal rates in all of our corporation, which means that you have to have a lot of young people coming into our audience mix because we have a high renewal rate. So if they get 1 year older as they renew, mm-hmm. What we really think that's important is it's a very interesting concept that we had adapted a number of years ago, and that's something called a life points concept. And the only way to explain that is that there's a certain period in someone's life through another series of life points that we think that you're a candidate to read our magazine. And the first time we think that you're a great candidate for us to get you as a reader is when you're married and own a house. As a matter of fact, 90%+ of our readership is married and own a home. And there are those certain life points, and we try to address life points all through your life in our pages versus just one narrow niche of life points. I think that's really one of the keys. And again, letting the readers tell us what they like and what they don't like versus the editor deciding what the readers like without any base points. I think those have been good things. But we are very much a national magazine. We have a special interest publication division that has as much circulation outside the South as it does in the South, all under the Southern Living title banner.
Linda, in Southern banking, what do non-Southerners have the most trouble with?
Is Louis Osteen here?
<laughs> Oh,
Louis probably thinks it's grits. We've had that conversation before. They're grits are so easy to make and yet so easy not to cook quite long enough. I think that the most interesting kind of culture shock for people coming to the South or are taking Southern food outside the South is cornbread. And I'm kind of like Cohen now. Any cornbread to me is good cornbread. I mean, you can make it with yellow and put some flour in it if you want to. But if you really want to make fabulous cornbread, you need to use white cornmeal and with very little, no sugar, preferably, and with very little flour or no flour in it. Mindy remembers quite well, I'm sure, about the marketing person that we had who came to Martha White from Chicago and told us in the Martha White Test Kitchen that he didn't think we knew how to make cornbread, which sort of got us a little infuriated. And so we finally, though, there are a few little tricks to cornmeal, as most of you probably know, has absolutely no gluten in it, so it tends to be dry and crumbly. And that's what people don't know how to overcome. So finally, by making some good, crisp Martha White cornbread in a cast iron skillet using buttermilk, we finally convinced Wayne that we knew how to make cornbread, didn't we, Mindy? So I think that's probably the hardest, although biscuits are the thing that I think takes people a little bit of time to get the touch. Mm-hmm. But to make good cornbread, you really have to have the right ingredients.
Thank you. And we had one general one, and then we were going to throw it open, so you guys be thinking real quick here. What won't you do in presenting the South for non-Southern audiences? What images do you stay away from? Ideas you stay away from?
No one wants me to take my clothes off. Well, I do think that our Southern flours are different. You can't make a good biscuit with a non-Southern flour, period. And, you know, I always just make that clear. I mean, I won't go anywhere without shipping flour to me. I think biscuits, by the way, are harder. I once was in my car, I have a Miata, and I had the top down, and I was at a stop sign, and a policeman followed me, and I do have a little heavy foot. And so I thought, oh, dear, you know, but I stopped at the stop sign anyway, and he pulled up next to me. He was on a motorcycle, and I said, hello, and he said, well, I just wanted to tell you that you taught me how to make biscuits, you know. And I think it takes, I think people think you're born knowing how to make biscuits, but you're not. And you have to learn how to make them. You have to watch. There's a technique. Everyone's technique is different, but there, whatever biscuits you're making, there's a technique to make that one. So I won't use other flours for them. But also, I think when I represent the South, I want to represent the broad spectrum. And I won't compromise. I won't make it be that everyone in the South is a redneck. I won't collude with that kind of thing. So I think that's probably what I want to do. Can we ask them when we turn it back over to them, how many of them make their cornbread with sugar and how many of them make it without?
And how about the people who make it without?
Without.
Yeah. Ms. Wallace, I didn't see your hand.
Good for you.
Okay. Anybody else got anything to add on what you don't do when you're marketing this out? Nope. Cool. Okay. Everybody, we're time for your questions. Mr. Long?
Bill, I wonder geographically where do you do best?
My best market today is Washington, D.C. Probably second would be St. Louis. And then Memphis, very good market for us. And then we are very strong throughout Atlanta, Georgia, and those areas. Those are best markets for us.
Yes, sir. Mr. Edgerton, sir.
Got stores in Nashville that carry your food?
Nashville?
Yeah.
Kroger's, Mid-Mountain in those stores. We pretty much have 100% distribution in Nashville.
And then I want to ask John Boyd, what would be your rationale for not wanting to increase your subscriber base outside of that?
What would be the rationale for not increasing the rate base, subscriber base outside the South? Basically, the rationale is we're a regional-based publication whose marketing focus to our advertising community is in the South, and half of our revenue comes from advertising and half comes from CERC. That's the basic premise there. Circulation outside the South is counted, but when people come to us, they don't come to us like for a national presence, but we're basically a magazine that most magazines are under-circulated in the South, and we even up the circulation when you add Southern Living to many advertising schedules in the South.
Scott, yeah.
I have the privilege of working with Floyd every day, so I'll address this question to the other panelists.
Good.
We're trying to be as forward-thinking as possible about selling the South, but if we can step back for a second. How do we address selling the South to my generation and the generations after me, who I think obviously are losing touch with the practices and cooking and ingredients that seem so inherent to us? And I know that I have many of my friends and that have very little interest in cooking and couldn't get in the kitchen and make cornbread if they had gone to bed. So how do you reckon we fix that?
The question is, how do we market the South to a younger audience who's not familiar with the
practices?
How do we maintain our traditions for a younger audience?
A very interesting thing. Do you know that until Jimmy Carter, until the last energy crisis, the power companies all and the gas company and everyone all taught everyone how to cook, that's where a major part of the learning was done. And when the energy crisis came, one of the Carter mandates was that they stop stop trying to make people use more electricity. This is a fascinating little known kind of a thing. And when that happened, they closed all their cooking schools and got rid of all their home economists. So this kind of fed right into what you're talking about, because those classes used to be free. You could go to your local power company and sit in the back and learn how to cook. They had this idea that people would all go to community kitchens to cook. I mean, it was, I don't know where that came from. But anyway, it has never been reinstated. So I think that the only real way now is to try to figure out ways to get some of those kinds of programs reinstated. I'm hoping that if there is ever an energy crunch again, that the opposite will happen, that the government will see that there is a need to encourage people like the power companies or whoever to go back into it. I'm fascinated that, for instance, Viking Ranges has cooking classes. All sorts of people are now starting cooking classes, and I think that's the only way. The only way people can learn to cook is by seeing it. I mean, you can only read so well much and understand how to do it, I think. And so I would say cooking classes. I know you all sponsor those big things, but I would love to see you go into communities and do
just go around and teach people how to make biscuits.
Well, I know our county home economist is no longer called a home economist.
That's right.
We've gotten rid of that title.
It's a bad word.
Yeah. Linda, do you have anything to add?
I think that that's a very good point. There are very few places where, and I learned from my mother, and that's not where people learn to cook anymore. Kind of an interesting note when you said that about the power shortage. Kind of an interesting note. I remember in one of the recessions that there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about oats and grits and things like that are kind of a counter economic indicator. A lot of people have a lot of money these days and can afford not to be able to cook. But if, when the times aren't quite so good, a lot of people get a lot more interested in those kinds of things. So we certainly don't hope for that, but you might see that sort of thing. And one of the things, too, is at a certain point in your life, I think that you start wanting to know a little bit more about your roots. You start wanting to find a little family group, and then you also start being interested in the foods that were cooked in your family and that you grew up with. So as people get a little older, I think they tend to get a little bit more interested too when they start making their little nest.
Well, and when you have children, you can't go out every night. I mean, no matter who you are, you know, there comes a point when you have to say, we have to stay home 5 nights a week and cook for these children. So part of it is having children. Have more babies.
Don't teach your children how to cook. Have them buy Glory Foods.
We have found the honest man. Yes, ma'am.
I'll be ashamed of yourself.
And for our young women, but it's meaningful to, keeping a home, running the vacuum, cooking, taking care of your family. That's low class. You don't want to do that. You want to go out and work. We see it. We own supermarkets. My daughter here is in the supermarket business, and we can see what people, the young people, are buying and putting in their shopping carts. And it's all this prepared stuff. And a lot of them are WIC, women, infants, and children. A lot of them are food stamps. And I buy and cook for them, and they save money because they buy high-profit things that are already prepared out of frozen food. It's not nearly as nutritional. And she did a science study in the seventh grade, and she hid behind the counter and watched how people bought produce.
How they bought produce, how they bought meat, and how they selected their breads.
And the older people bought the fresh produce and that sort of thing, and the younger people bought prepared. But it's a trend in our country, and it's really, in the supermarket industry, we make more money off of a frozen pizza. But it's disconcerting to me because as a mother and everything, I want my girls to cook. I want them to make their own pizza. I want them to learn to do all these things because I don't want them to lose those skills and things that I grew up with. So we sold the bill of goods at home choice that those kind of things
and we have the food police. I mean, at the point that we said that the egg was evil, which I never did, then we had people stop making a boiled egg and giving it to a child for dinner, but sending them out to get a hamburger. I mean, that's what happened, essentially. And until we get through with this thing of having bad foods, we are not going to get people back again where they have a relationship with their food.
Do you have a question?
I suppose so. I haven't arrested her.
I think a little bit of what's going on is that we're never going back. We're never getting back to the place where there's somebody at home in the kitchen who prepares every day. Your grandma's not living with you. Your aunt's not living with you. Those people who did that are not there. And so we're never going to market grits as a, well, God willing, we're never going to market grits and cornbread as a depression food again. Like, you make this because it's cheap. So what we're doing is we're marketing it as a designer food. I mean, where I see that this stuff has a market right now is not, it's at Dean and DeLuca, and where people are paying $2.50 for the flour that we buy at the grocery, or they're paying for stone ground grits, etc. And what's possibly helpful is that that has a tendency to drive the larger market. When you eat in these places, or you can buy this and it becomes a very hip thing to do, it drives a slightly larger market. But I don't know that we will ever find a mass market for the kind of home cooking that we all remember and grew up with. I think it becomes more of a petite kind of thing.
Well, but, you know, my mother served those little frozen dinners with the little things and the little packages. My mother worked. She supported three children. She, you know, we were poor. We didn't have enough to eat. We depended on the egg man and the milk man. I mean, I didn't come from an affluent situation. But my mother still didn't cook because she was that working woman you talk about. She rode the bus to work, rode the bus home, you know. So we had those frozen TV dinners and Swanson's things and Dingy Moore's stew. But I cooked. So I do think, and there is a generation that is cooking. So I think these things are cyclical. I'm not as depressed as you are about this. I think these things. I mean, I think these things are cyclical, and I think they're more than boutique. You know, I do.
We're just about out of time, and I think we have just another question or two. Lewis had his hand up here.
I was just with a bunch of chefs the first part of the week. We talked about this, and we sort of see this as sort of happening. There used to be a line between restaurant food and home food. But I think the line's been erased, and I think you see that most restaurants now are beginning to look back to this old comfort food thing, and they're beginning to do things people's grandmothers used to make, and now nobody makes them. So I think the restaurants will supply that.
And I think, do we have time for one more question?
Do we have time for one more? And please have four more questions so Kathy can rephrase.
I have to do something up here. A question? Ma'am?
I don't think that we're trying to reinvent the wheel, but specifically for my age group, and I think this young gentleman back here and I are probably in the same one, how do we go about, besides exposing them to the Food Network and all these wonderful teaching-type cookbooks, how do we draw them in? I mean, you know, I have people in my village that somebody's never tasted a strawberry. I mean, I just think that's absurd, right? Well, I've never tasted that before, and instead of eating it, I want to smell it first. I mean, you know.
So your question is, how do we draw in younger cooks?
Use all of these wonderful tools to educate our customers.
I know that there is an enormous difference between the viewership. I did 130 shows for the Food Network, between the Food Network viewers and the PBS viewers. It was the PBS viewers that put White Lily at Dean and DeLuca, not the Food Channel. So that the Food Channel drives people more towards entertainment. And what we have to do is to keep hoping that people are willing just to teach cooking. And we have to try to demand it of our television shows rather than just being entertained, although that has a place. I mean, I like that Iron Chef guy myself every once in a while. But, you know, that's not where I learned to cook.
I might comment that we do a tremendous amount of surveying. We know a lot about our audience, and probably the people are surprised, but we really sort of listen to our readers and try to develop our product based on our readers, and I do think sometimes we can create some stir in the marketplace. But, you know, cooking from scratch does not mean to your generation what it means to Natalie's generation. On my generation, we're close in age. We've got to first realize that. I think there has to be a bit of admission here. And then we've got to work with their base point and develop from their base point the characteristics. And actually, Bill's not too far wrong. I mean, convenience foods are exactly what they've done. It's the quality of the convenience food that you have that makes the difference, and how you can help them understand the convenience side of it and blend it with the other issues that becomes a great meal. A good example, we did something called a two-step pound cake, and pretty controversial in that it was cake. My mother said son? You don't do pound cakes that way. So she made, I said, well, just give it a shot. Mother, my wife did it and thought it was fine. Our test kitchen gave it a very high rating. She did it. She said, well, I don't think the text is just right. I think it's got a little bit of, you know, it just doesn't look right. My mother-in-law did it and said, son-in-law, you just don't do cakes that way. Her response to the two-step pound cake, my mother thought it had a little bit too much holes in it, you know, that wasn't dense enough. My mother-in-law's response, it was too dense. Basically, both of them now are using this two-step pound cake as their base cake. But what we did the two-step pound cake was because we wanted to ask the question, and we see that the pound cake is still the most made-from-scratch cake today. We still are producing a very high-quality cake, by the way, that rates very, very well. On the other hand, we tried to simplify but not lose any of the quality of the product. Coming back to that thought process is that their base point today is very different than my base point. I won't say Natalie's base point. And I think we've got to remember that they're not going to play in our field, but we've got to help them play in their field and understand our base points. And I think that works pretty well, and people are receptive to that.
Thank you. And unfortunately, I think we're out of time, but I know we've got lots of questions about this.
Well, pre-washed spinach is a good example of what you're saying. I don't wash all my spinach my hand either. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.